Hello there, Daniel McConnell from the Irish Examiner, and welcome to our one-on-one interview with Taoiseach Micheál Martin. Amid all the uncertainty about COVID-19 and the ongoing impact it's having on all our lives, we had an awful lot to discuss with the Fianna Fáil leader when we met him in his office in government buildings on Friday. This is Micheál Martin. I hope you enjoy. Taoiseach Micheál Martin, thank you very much for sitting down with us today. Obviously, Taoiseach, the uncertainty around COVID-19,
yep.
The rollout of the vaccine is occupying everybody's mind at the moment, and obviously the news now that the numbers coming out of AstraZeneca are far lower than what we had anticipated. That obviously has a knock-on consequence for when the country opens up again. We're obviously in a holding pattern at level 5 until March 5th. What happens after March 5th?
Well, I think first of all there are three key factors here at the moment that's governing the strategy. One is actually getting hospital numbers down and ICU numbers down and keeping them down. We're all aware of the enormous pressure they were under for the last 3 weeks in particular. We just don't need to go back there again, and we cannot ever go back there again. And that will be a factor. You know, where we are at the end of February and the beginning of March in relation to hospital numbers and ICU numbers will be a big factor here, because the frontline workers have been under enormous strain and stress. I'm worried about burnout there, and they need a break. Secondly, the variant. What impact will the variant have in getting the numbers down? So far, so good. The numbers are declining steeply. NEFET are very pleased with how the public have responded. I'm very pleased that the public are really responding to this. That will be a big help. And thoroughly the vaccination rollout then, because the more we vaccinate, the more we prevent mortality and illness among vulnerable groups. So the way I see it, and as we speak, you know, AstraZeneca will be, there will be an announcement in relation to AstraZeneca. You know, I was never, after March then, to come to your question, I think we will have to be conservative and cautious in terms of reopening. I think schools are number one priority.
Okay.
Special needs schools first. We're going to have to deal with the leaving certificate and respond comprehensively to the anxieties that students have in terms of that. And then a phased return of schools, beginning at primary level, during the next number of weeks, with the partners in education. I think construction is next, because that is an essential service, and house building in particular, because we have a big social crisis that hasn't gone away because of COVID. And in relation to everything else, then we will assess it closer. But I did use the phrase in the Dáil deliberately, a prolonged suppression of the virus, because I really want to get the numbers down, because I think it makes sense to be cautious now, given that the vaccination has been rolled out. Now, on the vaccination numbers. Q1 was always going to be low volume. I remember, I think I said it to you, and I think you wrote it actually, then, you know, that in December I might have said January, February, low volumes, building up during the summer. And August, I think, was a date, September, that we'd have a significant majority done of the population. So AstraZeneca has been a bump in the road, but the volumes...
Some may say it's more than a bump in the road, Taoiseach.
We'll see in terms of two issues today. Well, one will be the authorization and the nature of that authorization, and secondly,
the numbers.
So I think we will get our numbers as committed for February. We're not clear about March, okay? But we will be able to roll it out to the over 85s. The vaccination program will, first of all, we more or less had the majority of the nursing homes done, bar those that had COVID outbreaks, both residents and staff. We've about half of frontline healthcare workers done, up to 77,000 plus. There's about 150,000 healthcare workers out there. That's the next stage. Finish
them,
second doses, right?
But you will accept, though, Taoiseach, and Stephen Donnelly took some flack in the Dáil about, you know, the numbers and the deadlines keep changing and the slippage all the time in terms of the numbers.
Everyone has said that, though. I mean, from Colm Henry, everybody has made it very clear from the beginning this is a supply-driven issue.
So is that criticism then of Stephen Donnelly yesterday, as articulated by the opposition, unfair?
Very unfair.
Very unfair.
Kind of very taken back by it.
Okay.
Because I think it's a lot of noise about, we all know the realities in the first quarter.
Okay.
Everybody, I mean, it's not his fault that AstraZeneca have had this massive row with the Commission. And I think the publication of the contracts today seemed to bear out what the Commission was saying, that there were commitments there, you know, that they entered into. But there was always a worry. One of the big developments has been the vaccines themselves so fast. I subscribe to the European view of, you know, we combining our resources, pre-purchase, that gave development money to the companies as well and security to invest. In double quick time compared to normal,
absolutely,
we have vaccines coming on stream. there was always a sense that there could be challenges around manufacturing capacity across Europe, across the world, because everybody's looking for the vaccine at the same time. Mm. Vaccines are coming on stream. And there's a bit of that playing out now in terms of the first incident was by Pfizer-BioNTech.
Yeah.
That got sorted, albeit it led to a week's disruption. It could have been 3 weeks. It's much more serious with AstraZeneca.
Yeah.
And so therefore, I take it, the one point I would make, we do have to be very cautious. We can't say to people that things are certain. They are not.
Yeah.
They could be interrupted. But we have higher orders now coming in from Pfizer-BioNTech because Europe took, as you know, additional orders from them in terms of options.
Okay.
And Ireland took those up immediately in terms of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine and Moderna. Johnson & Johnson is another very significant vaccine that will probably arrive around early April, maybe before, if things go in the right direction.
Stephen Donnelly again said, I suppose it was his hope and ambition, while saying not a promise, but his hope and ambition that the public or the population would be vaccinated by September. Is that a realistic deadline?
Well, I mean, that's. I think within that time frame, we will have a critical mass. I mean, I can't say whether it'll be the entire population done at that stage, over 18. But I think we'll be well on the road by,
do we know
by
when?
Bar AstraZeneca, what's playing out is, as we were more or less told, around December. December last.
Yeah.
To me, April, May, June, July will be big months.
Okay.
Either way. And that's when you move to supply problem. The supply won't be the issue. The issue then will be administration of the vaccine.
Yeah.
Have we the workforce in place to administer the vaccine? The vaccination centres, a lot of work has gone into that. So, you know, the GPs have been signed on, pharmacists.
Did you mention at the PP the other night that dentists might be drafted?
Yeah, there's a whole list of other potential healthcare workers that could be used to vaccinate. Retired GPs, for example.
Sure.
Dentists would be obvious candidates for, because they're professionals, they have the capacity and so on. Also occupational health. Some companies have come to us saying, you know, in terms of the manufacturing industry, can we be of assistance to you? Mm. And the task force are exploring all those with the HSE in terms of making sure that over and above your GP pharmacist cohort, that you will have a sufficiency of workforce to work in vaccination centres to vaccinate the population as the vaccines come on stream.
So are we in a position, even say by the end of the year, into spring of next year, that we could envisage the entirety of the population being vaccinated?
Yes, I would envisage that, yeah. That would be the target.
End of year or spring?
Or before, I would like to think by end of year.
End of year, yeah. Okay.
But again, look, that's subject to the caveats.
Of course, yeah. The caveats are well...
It's a supply chain issue, really.
Boris Johnson and someone in the Tory party in the UK are boasting about they'll have an excess supply within the next 5 to 6, 7 weeks. Have you rung him to say, listen, can we get some of your excess supply over here in order to...
I believe in working within the European network. And look, they're taking different decisions, which... I'm not so sure I'd be entirely comfortable with the spreading out of the interval dates. The companies are saying our data is within 21 to 28 dates, certainly Pfizer BioNTech. I think there is a sense, which is dangerous, that people think if we get the first dose, we're fine.
Yeah.
You know, you're not.
Yes.
The second dose is what closes the deal in terms of immunity and safety, and people have to be very conscious of that. So I get the sense in the UK they've driven on. They may be right in the end. They've driven on because of the variant has gone, ran through Britain. It's the dominant variant in all the cases. So there's probably real concern there that they're moving at pace to vaccinate.
You've been very clear this week, obviously, in light of all the quarantine measures that you've announced, and you know your repeated message is, you know, no, don't travel. So people are obviously looking to what they'll do for their summer holidays and staycations and all the rest of it. Will the country be open come the summertime for people to actually enjoy their summer? Will the pubs, the restaurants be open come summertime?
Well, at this stage, I think the summer, people will be able to enjoy the summer, but in what context? I mean, the weather will be better, hopefully, and all of that. The hospitality is an open question. We haven't made any call on that yet.
Okay.
It depends on where we are on vaccination. But I'm going to be very cautious, to be honest with you. I think we will start where I said, and then we'll have to look at retail. But again, you know, I'm very conscious we've got to get the numbers down very, very low. And I think we have to have a conversation with opposition and with the general public. Mm. My sense is if we're rolling out the vaccine, there's no point in being taking risks. The vaccine will give us ultimately the protection we require from illness and mortality and maybe transmissibility as well. I mean, the evidence, the jury's out on that, but I think there are some views that the vaccines will also be effective in preventing transmission. And if that's the case, we'll be in a much better position. I put it this way, I think we'll be in a better position to make choices and decisions around May, June because of the vaccination program.
Yeah. You said at your parliamentary party meeting, you gave the figure of 800 people coming in via flights, and, you know, 397 of them were basically essentially coming home from their holidays. There's been a lot of talk of, you know, a lot of annoyance around that sort of fact that people are coming home from some, you know, Christmas holidays or winter holidays. Should they face tougher sanctions? Like, should people who are caught doing that go to jail? Because people are saying that they should not be able to walk off the flight and go home, as they were clearly shown by the RTÉ report.
Anyone who's demonstrably in breach of level 5 should be accountable in terms of the penalties that are there for level 5. I don't want to develop an over-draconian sort of police state approach either.
Sure.
To this, because we do need buy-in from the public. I was surprised and annoyed that so many went overseas during the Christmas period. Mm. The variant has put a new dimension to this, to be fair, all round, but the variant makes it doubly, that people need to double down on not going abroad now, yeah, and not going overseas. And that is why we will have the police checking at the airport. The Gardaí will be there and at the ports to prevent this from happening.
Thinking locally, I mean, like the GAA team were, you know, there's an investigation going on because the Cork GAA were training down in Youghal. I mean, is that acceptable? And should people involved face sanctions for breaching
guidelines? If people were in breach of guidelines at that particular time, like, that's not acceptable. People shouldn't be in breach of guidelines.
Yeah.
And level 5 has come in, as you know, during the Christmas week and so on, and has been strengthened then since then. So I think, but no, to be fair, talking to the chief medical officer, talking to the HSE, I mean, Philip Nolan and Tony were saying to us the other night that basically this has exceeded their expectations, mm, the degree to which people have responded.
Okay.
Because with the variant, the big fear was that the variant would retard your decline and would moderate the decline. Because what happened in the reason they discovered it in Britain was in Kent, they had restrictions in place and the cases weren't coming down. So they went researching and they found they found the variant.
Yeah. Going back to the Leaving Cert, and you mentioned that it's still a decision that's supposed to be taken. When will that decision be taken?
Well, we will be meeting. There will be an education committee next week of the cabinet in relation to this. I wanted to give space to the minister and the department. I met them last Friday. Mm. They've outlined certain options that they will be pursuing with the partners in education, which includes the students.
Yeah.
And there's a national advisory committee that have been sitting all along on the exams, and the state examination board will have an input. We do get the fact that students are under enormous strain and stress, and that we do need to bring clarity. But it's a bit, I discussed earlier, which, you know, there's a growing, in modern era, people want decisions the next day.
Sure.
Whatever decision we take will have implications for the students, not this month, but in June and July, and perhaps beyond, in terms of progression into third level or apprenticeships or whatever program a student will pursue. So we're very conscious of that too.
Yeah.
And we have to see beyond the immediate now, as we make these decisions. But I think, you know, we will, I think students will respond. I think there'd be I think what we'll emerge with will be something that will give the students the comfort and the clarity that they require right now.
What are the options?
Like the options, I mean, I don't go through them here because there are discussions going on, but we do know obviously that there's some students want the grades process that we did last year. Some don't want a sit exam, some do.
Yeah.
What's key to us is that there has to be a sense that students, you know, the students of this year will have a certificate, you know, of achievement, that they will have completion to their second level education. That will allow them to progress to other forms of education or work. And obviously the options are there's quite a number of options, but there are choices there. I think education are working with the partners now in terms of settling down on the precise options. I'm not in a position to give you those right now.
I suppose just one, because I think it would be interesting just to even explore this, but a lot of the education partners or unions who I've spoken to and representing teachers' bodies, and I sit on the board of management myself, the feeling is either if you can't do the full Leaving Cert, traditional Leaving Cert, that is some sort of hybrid model may be possible or should be even explored, that they give them some chance to sit an exam, but it might not be possible to the full extent.
Well, you see, that's one approach. There's a calculated grades is the other.
Yeah. But they seem very unkeen on, or not keen
on that. Yeah, but you see, you can be unkeen or lacking.
Yeah.
People are not keen on the calculated grades. Neither are people keen to go back too early to the classroom, which I understand in terms of the although I think something could be facilitated there in time, given the numbers coming down now. Mm. I think we shouldn't close off that. But nonetheless, if you're closing that off, then that puts pressure on the capacity to have the written exam.
Yeah.
So those are realities. I mean, we, like, what's key to the written exam is class time and yes. classroom engagement between the teacher and the student.
Mm.
So we have to take that reality into account. And that's exactly what's been discussed now between the minister and not just the unions, but the yeah. students as well.
You've made no secret of the fact of your passion for education yeah. and you're making it a priority. I mean, have you a preference yourself as to what you'd like to see?
Well, I think we'd like to give options to the students.
Okay.
I would like to think the more we can move back towards normality in education, the better. Now, this year's cohort have had the double misfortune, of losing out some months last year and this year. So we just have to be reasonable about that and take yeah. that on board and take that into account
yeah.
in whatever we do. But when I say move back towards normality, I do understand the importance of having the leaving certificate. Having a leaving certificate this year. We did have one last year, albeit very small numbers yeah. in November, and we had it in the middle of level five
yes.
last November. So the capacity to have that is there. The issue is the students getting classroom time with teachers.
Mm. And I mean, obviously there was an annoyance amongst an awful lot of your colleagues in government that essentially Norma Foley tried once and then twice to get schools open in a limited form, but was essentially stymied by, as she calls them, the education partners, the teachers' unions, led some to think, well, who's running the country? Like, do the unions have too much power in this process?
I actually don't think it was the union leadership in the end.
Okay.
My sense is that there was a mass movement out there, and there was genuine anxiety amongst the grassroots of teachers and special needs assistants. The very fact that 16,000 went
people
online
to the webinar
with the public health consultants tells me that.
Mm.
I was picking it up myself. I have a lot of contacts in the teaching world. Sure. And what I would term moderate, reasonable people were saying, there's a lot of nervousness out there. And when you think back, the numbers were very high in the community. They're coming down. They're still high, but they're coming down. And the variant you see really, I think, worried people. If a variant is 50 to 70% more transmissible, notwithstanding, the public health doctors did say and are saying schools are safe places and with the proper controlled environment and the protections and so on. But it seems to me that I think there's good work progress being made on special needs education. I think something similar could happen at leaving certificate level. And in the context of a phased return, we wouldn't have to have the million back at the one time.
Yeah.
That was the big fear. And I think that would help in the coming while, maybe to get an agreement on the leaving certificate in particular.
So just for clarity, and I know it's all subject to, I suppose, agreement, what, the indicative timeline, so special needs or kids with special needs first,
yeah,
by the end of February?
Yes, yeah, maybe before that if we can.
Primary school kids by the end of?
Well, we'd like a stage return of primary school kids okay. again before the end of February if
okay.
we can. I think special needs would come earlier.
Earlier, okay.
And see how that works out. The leaving certificate, I think, will depend on the talks that are now yeah. going on in terms of the options that will come back to government from the minister following her discussions with the partners. And that includes the students, and I have to stress that their voice has been listened to.
And are we looking at, say, the proposal as it was, like a 3-day week as opposed to a full 5-day
week? We'll see.
So that's an open question.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Moving on to another topic, and this is one that, as a paper, we're kind of keen on, is, you know, Ireland's role on the UN Security Council. And the former Taoiseach, now Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Coveney, condemned the Russian, I suppose, apprehension or capture of Alexei Navalny. Is Ireland going to use its position on the Security Council to, I suppose, condemn Russia directly on the Security Council and force them to, I suppose, let him go? Or what's Ireland's official position in relation to that?
Well, our official position is similar to the European Union partners, where we've condemned the imprisonment of Navalny, but also what happened to Navalny prior to this.
Yeah.
And there's been an ongoing tension between Russia and the European Union, and sanctions have been imposed because of the Ukraine. But the Navalny, incident brings in a very sinister element to this.
Mm.
And on the Security Council, we will be a voice for democracy. We will be a voice for, for free speech. But also, there's a practical edge to the Security Council
yeah.
in terms of. It's the very height of diplomacy at work, working out the compromises. We have a role in some important files, particularly in Syria with Norway, for example, and also in terms of climate and security around the climate change agenda, and also the Iranian nuclear situation. So Ireland, the bona fides of Ireland are well accepted internationally. And I can recall when I was foreign minister, it was both Russia and the United States wanted Ireland to take over the chair of the OSCE at the time, when they both came to see us and said, would you do it? And we said we would. It was back in 2010. So, and that I can recall another during the UN General Assembly when on the most difficult and complex issues, nuclear proliferation in the Middle East, the one country that could be deemed to be the most effective in chairing session on that was Ireland. So I think we bring a certain sense of diplomacy, a conflict prevention experience, conflict resolution. It's a more thematic approach than going on the Security Council to condemn one country versus another country. It's just trying to work out and prevent conflict and to try and resolve issues.
What I suppose a lot of people say, because I was there in New York at the time of the launch, so I went, I was part of the travelling delegation that went to New York, and again the constant question we were always asking was, right, what does this mean for Ireland other than, I suppose, being a kind of a fillip in the cap for officials? Like, I mean, what does it practically mean for Ireland as a country?
Well, I think it builds up our human capital, actually, in terms of the international diplomacy, the profile of the country, the prestige of the country, the degree to which the country can contribute to world problems and how we can be problem solvers. And I see it much more. It's not just about, because we've been there before, but it's, can Ireland bring value to the international stage through our own experiences in conflict resolution, but also our principles around multilateralism, around supporting developing countries, and now increasingly to take a leadership position on climate change. But our diplomats who will be at the seat here, and you know, will be working in all these files, you enrich yourself that way in terms of human knowledge and capital. You build up important contacts. And makes Ireland a country that is respected globally for the contribution it can make. And that's the longer term, because we have a strong diplomatic network in Ireland. I think, having been a former Minister for Foreign Affairs, I have great respect for the people who work there. And that matters, I think, in terms of how a country is perceived. Matters. It takes time for all of this to filter through, but in terms of being a destination for direct investment, in terms of being seen a country that's stable, has good values, good principles. People want to work with you then and want to engage with you. I remember when we did the cluster munitions ban, you know, countries like Norway, Peru were all happy to work with Ireland on issues like that.
Moving on to another topic, because I'm conscious of time. You're 8 or 9 months now in this job, and you know, by any stretch of imagination, you've had a whirlwind of myriad of and of challenges. You know, you've lost ministers, you've had turbulence internally, your party's poll ratings are probably lower than you probably would want them to be, and obviously you're dealing with a pandemic and Brexit. I suppose, how are you coping in the job? Because a lot of people have said to me, you know, Jesus, like, how does he get up in the morning, given all that you're facing? I mean, it must, at some stage, get in on you, or does it?
No, I mean, I'm fine with all that, actually. I suppose, look, political decision-making was never a problem with me, or the nuts and bolts of politics. No, yeah, coming in, the COVID-19 is a worrier. It's a big, big issue. We've got to put the country through COVID, because I can recall, as a Minister for Health, people talking about pandemics and saying, we must prepare for pandemics, but no one ever really thinking the pandemic was going to happen in their kind of lifetime, which was... There's always a problem with human nature.
But you've been confronted with such a
wall. The first month was a bit of tumultuous, turbulent. But at the same time, we got a hell of a lot done in the first 2 months. I mean, I think it's been a very energetic and productive government, not just legislatively, but actually, I see coming out of COVID, I see big changes in health. I think it's an opportunity once and for all to embed permanent reform in health, but it also will mean higher investment levels. And the 600 million we put into the Winter Initiative, and Paul Reid is saying this increasingly, it has
made the difference.
Yielded. It's, I mean, if we didn't do that, we'd have been in right trouble now in terms of the, you know, the high occupancy levels. So there's lessons there in terms of community interventions, in terms of making sure home care packages are there for the elderly and in demand.
They're all the things that got cut at the time of the crash last
year. And also in all governments guesstimated the monies that would be needed for the elderly, or the demographic, what's called the demographic increase, or an older population. So that ended up then that senior citizens were spending too long in acute hospitals when their treatment was over, couldn't get out into a step-down bed, or couldn't get a home care package to get home. The flow through the hospitals prior to this recent phase of COVID had been very good. We didn't have the same numbers on trolleys in October, November as the year before because of the investment, but there has to come reform as well. And I think that's the, that, that is, and I think out of that, the big piece we've learned, and you've you will pick it up in the vaccination thing about the IT network. The European Recovery Fund themes are green recovery and digitalization. Mm. I'm ensuring through the National Recovery Fund that we will have a ring-fenced fund to digitalize our health service and make sure we bring it up to speed to the modern world in terms of technology, which will, you know, electronic patient records and all of that. And that's something that, you know, I'm very policy focused in many respects. Yeah. So I want to.
But you're also unlike many Taoiseach, you're facing a very hard deadline. You know, you leave this office at December next year. I mean, obviously, your legacy or your ability to, I suppose, pursue your legacy. Because I look back on the speech you gave on the day you became Taoiseach. You set out a whole very extensive agenda in education, health, etc. You can do none of that because of COVID-19.
Well, I think in health we can. Yeah. I think health will never be the same again.
Okay.
I actually think we've learned a lot of lessons through COVID.
But do you not accept that much of what you would like to do is going to...
I think housing is the one I'd be concerned about. Okay. I think we're doing great. Well, I think Dara O'Brien has brought great energy into housing. We've put $3.1 billion into the budget this year for
housing.
But
all the targets are way off, though, aren't they?
Because of this lockdown now in the first 2 months, but we could pick it back up again.
Okay.
And I think on housing, we will make a difference. Yeah. Education, the very fact on day one, we set up a new Department of Higher Education Research, which was a commitment I'd made prior to going into government. And, you know, I'd made quite a number of speeches on research, and I've been committed to research all my life. And I think that will be a very significant change for the future of this country.
Yeah.
The Shared Island is another initiative we've taken.
Which we covered extensively in our paper over Christmas.
And it's up and running.
Yeah.
And it's up and running, and we're making progress on that. The 500 million ring fence funding now is certainly putting flesh on the bone in relation to things like the Ulster Canal, other projects like Narrow Water and that.
I don't want to get diverted off my train of thought, but there's one question in relation to the Shared Island I do want to ask you. And, you know, is the Shared Island not the perfect vehicle for you to improve cooperation with the North? Because, again, a lot of people are saying the lack of an All-Ireland approach in relation to COVID-19 undermines any strategy that we've been pursuing. And the fact that we haven't been able to get, you know, Ian Paisley 20 years ago, you know, was able to adopt an All-Ireland approach in terms of foot and mouth, but yet the current crop of politicians, North and South, can't seem to get it together. Surely the Shared Ireland Unit is the perfect opportunity or the vehicle to make that happen.
Well, the Shared Ireland Unit is predominantly about how we share the island together into the future, now and into the future.
A good first step, though, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, but you see, the difficulty is there's been politics within the North on this, so you know that. There's five parties on the executive. They've had fairly torturous discussions. They've got to the level five now.
Yeah.
We deliberately put the extension out to the 5th of March to align with Northern Ireland. The officials are working very well, actually. There's a difference between the noise at political level and the work that's underway between the two sets of officials.
Fair enough,
between the Northern Ireland office and officials in my department and Martin Fraser and his team and that. So progress has been made. The big issue is travel, and clearly unionism sees UK to Belfast as something internal. That's the way they look at that, and they don't see it perhaps in the same way we see it, in the context of public health. So we're working to see, can we get greater alignment around that, particularly with the arrival of the variants.
Yeah. You know? How frustrating is it to work with Arlene Foster and the DUP?
I wouldn't say frustrating. I would be in regular contact and touch. Obviously, you know, they would look at on the South and, you know, in a different way from how we would like, perhaps. They see the politics is never far away in terms of the North-South relationship. And what I'm trying to do through Shared Ireland is to just move to one side and get some pragmatic stuff done.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of going on the island of Ireland that doesn't respect the border. What I mean by that is that the economy is going well. I think the Brexit outcome, which was our first major challenge in the last 6 months, to just see that out, the protocol and so on like that. There will be work needed on that still. But we've preserved the all-island economy. We want to put new impetus into the North-South bodies. There's a billion coming on stream now in the next number of years from the Peace Fund on top of the 500 million, which we got some additional monies from Europe for that, which allow then Britain to give more and the Northern Ireland Executive to give more. I get on well with Arlene Foster on a personal level, and I maintain regular contact. There have been challenges. And I think issues like, it's clear within the North around COVID, you know, the Bobby Storey funeral, and I don't want to go into the pros and cons of it, but that didn't help relations in the beginning. Yeah. But I think Michelle O'Neill and Arlene Foster are doing their best to pull it together for COVID.
Looking back internally in terms of your own party, a number of your own TDs, Barry Cowan, Michael Moynihan, Sean Haughey, even last weekend, have said that you won't leave the party until the next election. You've clearly stated that you want to be Taoiseach and you will lead them into the party. Are they wrong? Are you right?
Yeah, I think I've made my position very clear. Like, I respect people's views and perspectives on this, but, you know, I think a lot of people in the parliamentary party want to focus on COVID, and they get the fact that the party can't be self-indulgent in terms of itself in the middle of a global pandemic, and it needs to put the country first and the people of this country first in terms of the issues. And I think all are agreed on that. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, this is a historic coalition, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, and the Green Party. And the composition is one, and then the policy platform with climate change, I think, will leave a lasting legacy. This government will leave a lasting legacy. That's my determination.
So you will be there for...
important that we make this work.
Yeah.
And if anything, since I became leader of the party, and I'll have my critics, you know, I have developed a more consensus style of politics in opposition. Mm. Now, that's not being reciprocated totally now. But, you know, in terms of the fiscal treaty, when we were only 20 seats, I could have played Molly Bond with that. I didn't. Yeah. I kind of did the right thing by the party and said we're pro-Europe. Lemass and Jack Lynch brought us into
Europe. You lost the deputy leader over that one, though.
And issues like that. But again, that's the point I'm making, is it would have been easier for me in opposition to play an opposition role. Likewise, obviously, I think there was a strong support in the party for marriage equality, but on the Eighth Amendment, we played a very constructive role in opposition.
Do the scars of, say, particularly the abortion issue in 2018, when, you know, a majority of your party sort of went against you, but you were obviously proved right in terms of public opinion, I mean, do the scars of that row still linger? Because there are clearly a number of your party who say, what's our identity? We're so low in the polls, we're struggling.
I think a lot of parliamentarians learned from that. And again, we did have the vote of conscience, which people respected.
Yes.
And you take someone like Mary Butler, for example, who's been a very effective minister for state for older people, and as a spokesperson in that area, and on dementia, was a brilliant opposition spokesperson, worked with Senator Colette Kelleher, did a lot of good work on dementia, for example. And I just witnessed Mary's determination and ambition for her portfolio and for the people that she's now representing as minister. And so there's no scars there in terms of, even though we'd have taken different positions on the Eighth Amendment. And that would be my attitude. I don't think the scars are there on that, to be frank. I think people have reflected on that too, and you know, when I was on the doorstep knocking on doors in relation to that, I also picked up amongst the public that there was no absolutism on that issue. You know what I mean? Like, some people voted yes, there might have been 70% on the yes way. Some people voted no, there might have been 60% on the no side.
You know, totally understand.
There are always nuances here.
And in fairness, you know, it was a remarkable sort of, you know, I think the poll results was a remarkable illustration of just how public mood had changed, and it may have been ahead of the political system.
What was also important, though, and we take some credit for this in the opposition in some ways, but the world had moved on. It was far less divisive than previous polls on that very subject, say, a decade earlier. Mm.
In terms of the party itself, I mean, you know, Owen Harris famously said to me back when I was with the Sunday Independent that, you know, a leader needs to treat his backbenches with contempt. And, you know, would you say you treat your own backbenches with contempt?
Not at all, no. I'm ringing them very often.
Yeah.
If only someone would testify to you. I mean, they contact me a lot and I ring them back.
Yeah.
I know. Look, I worked with them all.
Yeah.
Remember when the party, we had 20 seats in 2011, we had to build back the party. We won a majority in the first local election 2 years later, 3 years later. And I would have 22 of the TDs elected of the 24 TDs elected in 2016, I would have worked with on local election, knocking on doors with them.
Yes.
I worked with them in 2016, well in advance of the election, knocking on doors with them.
Yeah.
And even the TDs elected now, I worked with many of those. So I'm in very good first name terms with all of the TDs. I think, obviously, when we got into government, the last election, we would have preferred a better result. No question about that. And that created, question, tensions and concerns, and that I understand. And then when you're into government and then you're making appointments, we just didn't have enough portfolios for people who would have had a genuine
shout.
Sense of, I could be in for a shout for a minister, and that would create disappointments, and that's always been the way in politics,
but do you think
from my
that,
experience.
And taking, say, for the example of, say, Michael Moynihan, your former chief whip, you know, he was very critical of you on radio 2 days later. I mean, was that just purely there wasn't enough room for him? Because he would have, I suppose, as your former whip, he would have had a genuine ambition to at least
He would, of course, yeah. And absolutely, we just didn't. I mean, we had a limited number of positions. It was a very, very difficult choice, impossible choice. And former Taoiseach would say that to you. That's the worst day, actually. You just get elected, but then you have to pick your cabinet nominees and your ministers of state, and that's the most difficult part of it.
Is there any road back to a ministerial position for Derek Leary, your former deputy leader?
There are always roads back. There's always. I mean, I've learned that in politics, and people. Politics changes very fast as well.
But I suppose I asked a question in specific about Derek Leary because he resigned so quickly. He was seen to take a very honourable stance in terms of the mistake that he made by going to the event itself. And, you know, I suppose he a very capable individual.
He's very capable and very constructive member of parliament, and I think well liked across the house. But I mean, obviously we have ministers now and so on. Yeah. But I do. I mean, I think
The door's not closed.
The door's never closed on anybody.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think Dara has a very strong career ahead of him. And by the way, just on the party.
Yeah.
Like, we had a very good session the other night where numerous presentations were made on behalf of people who would like to get our nomination to fill the Shannon vacancy. Mm. And I just looked at that and said, oh, wow, like, that's a very, very talented, diverse group of people from Ramu and Longford right through to...
She had the line of the night, really, I think, did she?
She had, yeah. She was strong. But I said to myself, you know, okay, you've been leader. This is exactly what I wanted to do. I remember saying at the time I wanted to create a new generation of politicians. Yeah. And we have a very good talent base within the parliamentary party.
Yeah. So why are your poll ratings so low?
I'm not worried about the poll ratings, genuinely. And I think some of the Red Sea stuff, it's online polling now. It's not comparable to previous polling.
Okay.
But I'm very confident at the quality of the TDs we have and senators and councillors. Mm. And that's a key factor in winning elections and winning seats. So I wouldn't be phased at all, because I've been there before with the polls, so I'm not a bit phased by them.
Yeah.
I know how to engineer good election results. Okay, people say the last one didn't work quite out. I think we came in to the last election, people had us penciled in as favourites and so on that. Whereas in 2016, we came in well under the radar. Mm. People thought we'd be low 30s. And the dynamic of the campaign is the lesson I learned from it.
Okay.
That the dynamic is the most important thing. Yeah. A lot that goes on beforehand actually doesn't play out in the modern world in terms of the dynamic of a campaign itself.
Okay.
But if you recall, just 2 months before that general election, we won two by-elections out of four, and then we had won the local election when we had the largest number of seats.
Certain people, eminent pollsters, were saying you might get 60 seats.
Which is nonsense. Yeah. We knew we weren't getting 60 seats, by the way. Like, we knew that internally. But but at the same time, we would have been hoping for 24-25%, which would have increased your seat count numbers.
I noted your interview in the Sunday Independent last week where you softened your position in relation to Sinn Féin, that your dynamic or your relationship with Sinn Féin as possible coalition partners down the line is evolving, I think, not to misquote you, but is that you deliberately saying the dynamic is changing, that, you know, in the future, because you were so strident in your opposition to doing any sort of deal with them before the last election, do you see your party doing a deal with Sinn Féin?
I think it'd be very difficult to do a deal with Sinn Féin right now in terms of its policy platform.
Yeah.
It's just as... I think they're moving more and more to the far left in many respects. The economics of what they're saying, if you add it all up, doesn't work out. And their issues on enterprise, trade, and all of that is problematic. So, but what the context in terms of those remarks are that, you know, politics does evolve.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we will have a much more fragmented political world into the future. In many ways, PR, multi-seat PR is meant to give you fragmentation. For most of the 20th century in modern Ireland, it didn't give us fragmentation. We now have fragmentation, and I think it's here to stay.
Yeah.
So in that context, I think there's going to be an evolving situation where now whether politics gravitates back to the centre or goes to the extremes is an open question.
But just to pin you down...
We will be very much in the centre ground.
Okay, so just to pin you down on this, because you know, you're saying it's very difficult at the moment to look at doing the deal, but it is evolving. So that would strike me, and not to parse what you're saying, would lead me to think that there's potential to at least explore.
Yeah, I'm not predicting the future is what I'm saying.
Okay.
I'm not going to be saying something is never going to happen into the future.
Yeah.
But what I am saying very clearly, the current government has a strong, you know, there's strong complementarity on what we agree we can do. There's disagreements on some issues, so where we disagree, we can't progress them.
Yeah.
But on some key issues around climate, say you take climate, for example, Sinn Féin is regressive on climate, very regressive on climate, and wouldn't be doing the things that we're now doing with the Green Party. Of that, I'm certain.
Mm.
And it's a very populist party. And I think there will be real issues there. And it took so long to negotiate the programme for government with the Greens and Fine Gael. I would not underestimate the difficulties and challenges trying to sit down with Sinn Féin and negotiate a programme for government.
The other night, Bertie Ahern addressed a group of the Cush Fintor group of your party, and he's due to address, I think, the Cumann UCC next week. Do you have an issue with that?
No. I mean, I think he has made an enormous contribution in terms of the peace process and the Good Friday Agreement. He was the key architect with others of the Good Friday Agreement.
Mm.
So I think.
But he left your party in less than stellar circumstances.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I think in terms of the context of people wanting to hear what he has to say,
yeah.
you know, we live in a democracy. We live, you know, we talked about earlier in terms of Security Council.
Yeah.
You know, he speaks to academic conferences. You know, he speaks on the Downing Street Declaration right through to the Good Friday Agreement. He still works on the North, works with Republican groups and loyalists, you know, in terms of, and is involved in trying to progress issues in Northern Ireland. So he has an expertise in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And it's only natural that people would want to hear him speaking at a forum.
Is there, like, you two, obviously, relations obviously soured in the wake of his departure from the party, and some things were said. Now, obviously, he sent you a very gracious letter, I thought. It was in the papers last weekend, on you becoming Taoiseach. Some are seeing this, and some within your own party said it to me, they see this as the beginning of the road back for him to the party fold. Is that on the agenda?
No, I think what it is, you know, in fairness, he also, you know, logged on online to the Shared Island and participated in that, the first dialogue we had and the speech I gave and so on. And I spoke to him afterwards on that.
Okay.
In terms of his views, he endorses the Shared Island idea and the unit. He thinks it's very good work. And he offered any help and assistance he can make.
It's all sounding very positive, Taoiseach.
Well, no, in terms of deal, look, I think in terms of, like, to me, one of the passions that brought me into politics was Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was a young child when the bombs started going off, and it was a daily diet of our lives. And for younger generations, that may not be as, might not have that sense, but it was just, we never saw it ending.
Yes.
We never saw it ending. So to be in a government where the Good Friday Agreement happened, as I was in 99, was a great privilege. But and so I have a great passion to try and continue to make it work.
Yes.
And that's why I set up the Shared Island. And I think he has a particular expertise and insights on that and contacts, which are not just in this island, but globally. So I think, you know, anybody who can make add value to that whole agenda, to me, is worth listening to.
But in terms of, say, should an application come from Dublin Central to readmit him to the party? Yeah. Is that...
I don't think that's going to happen. I don't even anticipate that. No.
Okay. No, but would you have a view as if it did?
No, as I'm saying, right now, I think the engagement we have on policy issues is where it's at. Yeah.
One of the other questions, I suppose, I meant to say it when I was speaking about Derek Cleary, was the readmittance of three senators in the wake of Golfgate. I mean, obviously there was some controversy around the fact that both yourselves and Fine Gael did it at the same time. Was it appropriate to do that? And do you not think it sends out the wrong message that people who clearly were in breach of the rules are now essentially, you know, they've paid their punishment and moved on?
Well, no, I think people, they were punished, but I don't think it's fair that you punish somebody forever.
Okay.
I think they were very remorseful. I mean, they were really, when I spoke to them, they were just really very annoyed with themselves, very angry with themselves. So I don't believe that will happen again.
Yeah. What do you think your legacy will be when you leave this office as Taoiseach in December 2022?
Well, in terms of the key areas, in particular around housing, that I genuinely want to say that we've made a very significant impact on ensuring that people can both afford to buy houses and can get houses. In terms of health, to have fundamental reform embedded into the health system, and that we will have a new paradigm around health services into the future. And also, as leader of a government, of a historic coalition, that really... in a very impactful way, change direction in Ireland towards the climate agenda. And on the Island of Ireland issue, I genuinely believe the Shared Island would leave a very lasting legacy.
Do you agree with Bertie Ahern that a referendum could be possible by the end of the decade?
It could be, but I mean, I don't think... I don't believe that it's all about polls.
Okay.
You know, I think we should learn from the Brexit poll.
I mean,
you know, people had the poll, but my God, there's been some mess since in the 4 years afterwards.
But it's very clear Brexit has shifted the sands in relation to it.
Yeah. I'm aware of all those dynamics, and that's why I think we should work on a people-to-people basis.
Yeah.
I mean, my view on that is, look, the three sets of relationships that applied in the Good Friday Agreement, British-Irish, North-South, and the two traditions, will still apply no matter what structures are created in an island of Ireland in the future. We still have to work on those three sets of relationships. They're going to still be equally important no matter what the structure or where the fulcrum of power is. You could still, you know, so I think we've got to learn to live better than we have. And I don't think we've utilised the potential of the Good Friday Agreement enough. And that's the work that's needed. And I think with the ring-fence funding we have now, I think we can make a real telling impact here and do things properly on this island. A lot of progress has been made, and I think we can build on it.
I was struck again in a previous interview, I think, I can't remember.
And education is the other key area, and particularly on special needs education. I'm still not happy that there's enough advocacy for the child within the system, and around assessments and the multidisciplinary supports that children with special needs require. We want to see that transformed in both primary and post-primary education over the next while.
As I was saying, I was struck by an issue you gave previously where you described essentially locking yourself in here late at night, working hard and kind of watching matches, etc. like that. I mean, people often ask me, you know, do you relax? Do you get a bit of downtime? What do you do for, like, if you're up here and your family are in Cork, I mean, how do you spend your downtime? Like, what do you do to try and switch off?
The main factor there was COVID has been a very restrictive impact on all our individuals. Lives, yeah. You know, so you kind of it's there's no conviviality or congregation anymore.
Yeah.
So what I do is, I mean, I walk, I read somewhat. Not obviously, I'm the time frame to do all of that because of the job. There's a lot of work involved here, and COVID has really meant around the clock stuff. And Brexit did. I mean, Brexit took us right into Christmas Eve. And then we were in the middle of starting the second wave as well.
Yeah.
So there was no Christmas really, bar Christmas Day. But at the weekends, if I can get a good 2-hour walks in on a Saturday and a Sunday and get back to the family for a night, maybe at the weekend.
Are you trying to get it down at least once a week, are you?
Oh, I do, yeah. I'll get down tonight and I'll be back up tomorrow.
Tomorrow, okay.
Because I have more interviews on Sunday. And so I'll get a walk in and have a chat at home, really. But on the other side, there would have been a time if it was non-COVID world, we'd be at dinners on a Friday night,
of course,
Saturday night.
Yeah.
So you actually get a bit more quality time with family in a way.
Yeah.
But it's short because you're a Taoiseach and that you have to accept that, and the family accept that. That's part of the job.
What's the part of the job you like the most?
What's the part of the job I like most?
Is it this office? Is it the trappings, or is it being able to actually get something done?
I think it's getting something done. Yeah. Of course it is. That's what. Politics is essentially moving things on, making decisions.
Yeah.
I get great satisfaction out of making decisions on a whole range of issues.
Mm.
And that's prior to cabinet and getting conclusions to memorandums to cabinet and so on. I also enjoy the working with European colleagues. I've always liked that dimension.
Yeah.
I enjoy the European Council meetings. They're tough, they're long, but you get a great insight in terms of what's going on globally. And you know, you're dealing with 27 member states. Each have their own problems and challenges. And whether it's climate change or the stimulus package, recovery fund, or COVID. You know, these are very, very interesting and meetings. And they're from someone who's been involved in public policy all my life, I find that very satisfactory.
And the toughest part?
That engagement. Well, the toughest parts are when we have challenges like the last 3 weeks. That to me would have been the toughest part. There's genuine concern with rising hospital numbers, rising deaths, and people getting ill. And I was very worried about the hospital situation.
Okay.
And would have had daily engagements with Paul.
Worried that it would be overwhelmed?
That was a big concern. What more can we do to help you with staff? What more can we do on certain, you know, just tell us anything we can do, we'll do. But that, I think, you know, that was and continues to be a worrying aspect. And that's why I've said from the outset of this interview that, you know, we've got to really get those numbers down and give the people in our hospitals a break.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you share the view that Leo Varadkar's tried to undermine you at every twist and every turn since he's become Taoiseach?
I don't, no. No, look, we're two leaders of two different political parties.
Yeah.
Of course, there'll be a bit of jousting from time to time. But I think he is Leo. He's a different way of doing things and he's different approaches and he's and so on. And so people, I'm well known in politics, people interpret things that necessarily aren't what the politician intended in the first place.
Yeah. Have you had any major rows? You said you've jousted, but I mean, has there been any sort of, like, because people are just interested, I suppose, in it's a historic coalition, I suppose, people are interested.
What's interesting is, I think that cabinet coordinating meeting we have has worked.
Yeah.
It's a good forum. We have a facility where the three leaders will pick up the phone to each other very regularly.
Yeah.
And if there's an issue, he's upfront about raising an issue with you.
Yeah.
If he has a concern about something. And I think that is working.
What was the most testing issue? Because again, it just being like, I mean, was there a particular issue, say, like, I mean, say for example, when he went on TV and really put the boot into Tony Holohan and Neffet, I mean, was there a disagreement there?
Well, I mean, when you say disagreement, we just, I think.
Well, I mean, he made a very clear view that he didn't think Neffet had thought that thing through. But you were very clear the next day in your public utterances, you expressed confidence in Tony Holohan. There was a divergence on the surface.
And Leo, in fairness, re-engaged with Tony and made it up, so to speak. And, you know, so there wasn't an issue between, I mean, look, we've got to allow people space to say things. And so we're tolerant of each other's utterances.
Yes, okay.
I put it that way, right? I think the more, where the tensions have been, if there have been, and they haven't been huge, would be certainly around aspects of, you know, when you open up, when you lock down. There have been some areas around that from summer onwards, you know, people who have different perspectives.
Because they were obviously, some in Fine Gael were pushing for businesses to open earlier. That's it.
Yeah, and it's very trying because everyone's under pressure. Everyone's ringing everybody, you know, like it's, and I could see the seesawing in the Dáil.
You know?
Like, so there's people in the Dáil now who were attacking us for not opening pubs early enough, who know one zero COVID.
The president of Sinn Féin.
And one, but there's others, you know, and we've moved all that in 1 month, you know. So, like, people are changing views. So, we walked it through, you know, we walked it through. And, and what I like is once we walk it through, there's collective responsibility.
Okay. Yeah. One very final question, if I may. You were clearly very passionate about setting up a Department of Higher Education, but you gave it to Simon Harris. That has left an awful lot of people scratching their head. Why, if you were so keen on getting that department, would you not give it to one of your own?
Well, they're very keen on getting it established. Yeah. And we had the education portfolio. I didn't think it would have been wise to have two education portfolios in the sense that we were anxious about housing and health.
Mm.
They're tough, challenging portfolios, housing and health. But the key point was to establish the department. I think Simon is enthusiastic and enjoying that department, and I'm working with him on it. And my attitude is, I think he'll work well in that department. And we'll be meeting shortly now on research. He knows, and in fairness to him, he's read everything that he's clever. Right? He comes in saying, "You did say X, Y, and Z when you're in opposition." I think I agree with you, and I need the resources to do it.
Yeah. So he's done his homework.
Yeah. But I think, look, that's for me, it's the policy decision to set it up, and it's working.
Yeah. Okay. Taoiseach Micheál Martin, thank you very much.
Thank you indeed.
Well, thanks very much for listening, and be sure to check out the new Politics Hub on irishexaminer.com for all the latest in breaking news and analysis. Bye for now.